So,
Hello, friends.
welcome
We are
to the Lit
back.
Crank, episode 3. I am Jake, Cranky Ethicist on Twitter, with
Hello,
John,
hello.
the Lit Crit Cra guy on Twitter. Hopefully, the audio is better on my end this time. We're trying something new. But
Bumbling
really,
and
bumbling is our brand. That's
genial
who we are.
incompetence
We're bumblers.
is very
So
much
if
our brand. It is this is the third one. We've reached number three, and we will. Yeah, this is going to be
yeah.
good. This is going to be good. So, do you want to kind of introduce what it is we're going to talk about
Yeah.
and why you wanted to talk about
Yeah.
this?
Okay. So I'm actually going to do this backwards, right? Or I'm gonna go for an example first. So you're kitten, right?
Yes.
So for those of you playing at home, like John has a very, very cute new kitten. That like she's very scraggly looking. She's so cute. Like she's so ridiculously cute, right? And like she's got whiskers that do weird things. She's got like eyebrows that do weird things. Like she looks like sort of like rough and tumble, right? Her name's Scout. She's very cute.
Scrappy.
And so there's this feeling, right? Of like, oh, this is a really cute thing that this person has, right? This cute thing that I don't have, right? Because I've got adult cats that are just like rambunctious and awful, and like all they do is complain. So really, so like John, this is John's first kitten, maybe
Yes,
first kitten ever,
it is.
right? So like, as someone who's
First
had
time.
cats before, had plenty of cats before, things like that, I was like, oh, that's really sweet, that's really cute, but also I wish for that little like darkness, right? Because kittens are rambunctious little bastards, right? Cats do like kittens will just destroy everything, right? They destroy everything, including today. Today, John had technical difficulties because Scout just decided to run across the keyboard and disable the trackpad, and he had to restart the computer and all of these things. And in my own mind, I was like, yes, I was vindicated. Vindicated. Because this is what cats do. I warned you. This
I mean, you did. You did. You did warn me.
is a weird, weird sort of explanation or case for talking about resentment and Schadenfreude, right? So resentment. This sort of sense the like, oh well, you know, something that I want is being denied to me, or something that someone else has is something that I want, or something like that. It's this sort of like harboring of ill feelings, things like that. And then Schadenfreude is this like glee, like this. It's usually translated from German as malicious glee, right? This happiness, this joy, like really, like Freude as in joy, joy in the suffering of others, right? And I think both
That's
of
how it's
these,
kind of generally translated to my mind.
yeah, and both of these feelings are very, like, endemic throughout society, right? And they're sort of like really well linked into each other. They hold hands, right? So in my own backwards way of discussing this, like, there's a little bit of resentment in the fact that John has an adorably, absurdly adorable kitten, right? And he gets to start this whole experience all over, right? Because I just have like t I have like tired old cats, or like cats that like think that they're kittens, but they're just big and silly and don't know what they're doing. So there's this weird sort of sickness of try or like this sort of like feeling of like, well, he's gonna get tired of it someday, right? Or something like that.
It's yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. There have been
And maybe this is cruel, right? Or yeah, no, this is cruel. This is me being cruel. But like, I love the fact that like you have a rambunctious kitten that's like damaging your shit, like just all up in your shit and just damaging it. Because like, there's something just like some people just they need that little bit of chaos in their lives, right? And I want to point this out because I'm talking about someone who's a friend of mine that I have like these really like cruel thoughts about, right? Resentment and Schadenfreude often talks about like things that are enemies and stuff like that, but that's not really the case here, right?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I think I like the idea of getting back into it isn't a case of it's necessarily directed at someone you dislike. You know, this resentment and Schadenfreude can often be triggered by people who are sort of on the same side as you, especially if they've encountered something that is potentially really good, 'cause let's be honest, having a tiny kitten is kind of amazing. But there is also there's also a little streak within, I think, everybody of like, oh, just you wait, just you wait. I will say in Scout's defense that she is tiny and adorable and currently asleep with her tail on her nose, which is just so lovely. But I was literally about 20 minutes ago, swearing at her, quite like, because she had decided just to wander across my keyboard and had done something to my computer that I could not fix. Incidentally, one of my colleagues sent me an essay written by Emily Bronte about cats, which we will absolutely have to link to because it's kind of amazing, where she defends cats on the basis of the reason that cats are the kind of superior animal, she was definitely a cat person, is because they have all of these negative qualities to them, which people have as well. So dogs, she kind of dismisses as being like too good. Dogs are hashtag too good for this world. Whereas cats, she argues, are kind of much more understandable because they can be very nice, but they can also be horrible to
Oh,
you.
like,
So this is so you know, Bronte got it. She understood.
Cats are bastards.
Yes, but they're also adorable. Which I will absolutely put the link to this short little piece that Emily Bronte wrote back in the 80, back in, I think it's when she wrote it when she was at school. So it's a very young piece of writing, but it's a really fun defense of why cats are so
They're
good.
so
It's because,
bad.
like us, they're full of the worst
They're good
possible
because they're
qualities.
bad.
They're
And
full
this
of
is
awful
so
qualities.
this is really sort of this sense, or part of the sense that I wanna elaborate on is like we have this idea that there are people who we like or things like that. We have like we often joke about or we often talk about this idea that like love and hate are not really that distinct, right? Especially like Nietzsche is like the philosopher of resentment, or at least he's the one that is the reason that we talk about resentment in certain ways. And he has this idea that like your friend, right? A good friend, someone that you love and cherish and whatever, they make the best enemies, right? Because as soon as you have told your your like friends like these are all my secrets, these are all the things that I know and things like that, they become liabilities, right?
Oh
And I'll say this as someone who has had a lot of friends suddenly become enemies, right? Like, oh God, there's a handful of people who have like intimate details on me, and things like that. And that's just how we have to live, right? Is like, yeah.
You kind of have to negotiate that.
And it's something where like resentment can come so easily, even with those that you love, even with those that you deeply admire. You still have this little bit of jealousy. You still have this little bit of hoping to like be with them or something like that. And then if you're denied that in a way, or if you're like
Thwarted.
just sort of kept away from it, then you resent them, right? And it's very similar to this sense of, like I mentioned this the last time with the uncanny, right? But you have friends where or you have intimate friends, you have people that you know that you love and things like that. But after an argument, after a falling out or things like that, suddenly it's just like, a different thing, a sort of uncanny thing where you no longer see the friend in the friend's eyes, or you no longer see the friendliness in the friend's eyes, or you re
And if, well, I think it's a recognition, isn't it? It's a recognition of the kind of threat. There is a threat implicit in such a close relationship because it depends upon personal vulnerability. And if it's to be any kind of like healthy friendship or relationship, there has to be a degree of reciprocity. And if that reciprocity is withdrawn at any moment, because in a sense that's what an argument is. Suddenly you're placed in a very vulnerable position towards the other.
And that's it's difficult. It's extremely difficult to sort of navigate this, right? And it's hard, but I think really like resentment, right? If we talk about it as this, if we talk about it with Nietzsche, right? So he uses the French ressentiment, right? What we're gonna do is just me bumbling through French pronunciations of things, and it's like.
Again, a very
Yeah,
big part of our brand.
he wants to say that resentment is a worse is much worse than just being like openly angry, right? Or openly hurt. Like if you are able to like articulate your hurt, articulate your pain, like say like this hurt me, right? And whatever. That's better because even if that is a violent thing, because that's an immediate violence, right? That's an immediate thing that sort of just comes out, right? Whereas with resentment, with resentment, right? It's bottling, right? It's bottling up this sort of desire to destroy someone, or this desire to like of ill will towards someone or something like that, and you hold on to it for way too long, right? And it
I think that's very true.
and it's been like he sort of imagines this as like a festering wound. It's something that like just continues. It just harms you. It harms the person more than anything else, right? Because if you're resentful towards an enemy, you're resentful towards someone you don't like, but if you're quiet about it, really, like all that does is it harms you.
Yeah, it's a kind of internalized poison.
And he uses discussions of it being poisoning, and things like that. Really, all you're doing is you're poisoning yourself, over and over and over again. And like, I think that this happens all the time, especially within academia, is this sort of resentment mill.
Oh my goodness, yes. Good
Yeah.
grief.
Yeah.
Well, I think that I mean I shouldn't laugh about it, but it's kind of a laugh
Yeah.
in recognition. And I think we should probably s I think maybe it'd be useful to talk about why it's so common in academia, especially. Maybe not especially, but I certainly relate to it quite a lot.
Yeah.
And what it kind of looks like.
Yeah.
Because we both kind of work in different systems. I'm not usually familiar with the kind of day-to-day practicalities of US
Yeah.
higher ed. It certainly got a laugh of recognition out of me, but maybe you could talk about it in the context of higher education in the
Yeah.
US.
So in the US, like, it's a very, so we have a very paternalistic system, right? Like, it's not like, so students don't necessarily have like their students don't necessarily have like their projects put together until a handful of years in to their PhDs, right? Which means that like it has a lot of this sense of like back and forth, trying to figure out like who you can work with, who is a good match for you, things like that. And then there's also the coursework, which means that you have like you end up having to like write papers, write like mini papers, things like that, and pitch arguments to faculty, some of which are more engaged than others, of course, and things like that. So a lot of people out there, like they end up sort of living in academia these very vengeful lives, right? This sort of sense of well, so and so, this one faculty member didn't really like my work or like said something in an offhand way and that hurt me and whatever. And I still have to deal with like smiling to them later, right? Because it is something where it is a more continual process of seeing them as opposed to like the like coming in every once in a while for advisement or something like that. And yeah, so that's a whole difficulty in trying to navigate. But I think this is something that I've seen in myself. This is something I've seen in others, is this sort of like harboring resentment, harboring these like major grudges that are very, very silent. They're silent grudges. Or rather, they're grudges that are waiting for some sort of vindication, right? And this is why you're like, so Nietzsche, this is the reason that like Nietzsche thinks that Christianity is a religion of ressentiment in the genealogy of morality, is this idea that like Christianity suggests that all of the suffering that one has in one's life will eventually lead out to like the promise of something later. So like if we just hold on to our suffering, if we just hold on to our burdens and things like that, then we can almost vengefully take like our paradise, right? And he sees that like this notion of like divine suffering, or like the suffering that one undergoes in order to be devout, is damaging, right? Because it's just waiting for this. It's waiting for something that might not ever happen. It's waiting for something where you think that you're holier than other people around you, right? So people who are successful, or have power over you, or things like that. You hope for them to have like some sort of comeuppance later, right? Oh, well, you're gonna go to hell anyway. So like this sort of
So
mentality.
it's all gonna work out in my favor.
Yeah, eventually everything's gonna work
I
out for
think
me.
actually
And
that model that model that Nietzsche puts forward is a rich way of understanding trying to build a career in academia.
Yeah, I think so, to a certain degree.
There's so much that is kind of expected of a PhD student, of an early career researcher, that you are supposed to do on the understanding that there will be potentially, without guarantee, there will be a reward at some point. The common phrase is, oh, this will look really good on your CV.
Yeah.
And what that is code for is, here is a job that is time-consuming, demanding, will probably not be financially rewarded, mm-hmm. your labor will probably be unwaged, but we're expecting you to put up with this on the promise of some potential heavenly reward, which in this case is the increasingly mythical permanently employed position, or the tenure track position in the States. So I think maybe that's a really good way of understanding what it's like in academia. It's this, the promise of future reward for the justification
or rather what ends up happening, right, more often than not, is you lose sight of this idea of the reward, but you rather end up having this sort of sense of the destruction of others, right?
Yeah.
This is the important thing, right? And this is why I think resentment and Schadenfreude are so linked, is you end up not really thinking about like your own sort of possible paradise or your own sort of joy or something like that. You start to like really like what you're wishing for, what you're doing is the hope to upend other people, right? Or to prove people wrong, right?
Yeah.
And things like that. And that's that's the dirtiness, right? That's the dirtiness of this sort of resentment, is you hold on to this, right? I've known plenty of people who harbor these grudges, or like they get bad feedback on a paper or something like that, and they keep it, right? And they keep it, like they put it, like they just like sort of keep it in like a special file of like, here are all the rejections that I've ever had, or like
here are the receipts.
Here are my receipts of failure, right? So that later they can do not. So when they, like, if they have any sort of success, it's not so that they can, like, be like, oh, well, I've grown. No, it's so that they can, like, turn and rub it in on the people that
I'll show you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've done this too, right? Or I've had these sort of revenge fantasies too, right? There was a paper that I had that a faculty member didn't like. And whatever, and like it, like not only didn't like it, but like it was an anonymous review, and they this was one of my sort of capstone pieces for my, I guess, similar to what you call an upgrade paper, I don't know. It was a qualifying paper, and an anonymous faculty member like roasted it for no reason, right? And in my mind, I've been sort of like thinking of like, well, I could just like, if I get this published, I could succeed, and then I can rub it in this person's face. I spent like a large amount of time like trying to conjecture who it was that had this anonymous nasty feedback and things like that. And not just for like the practical thing, or like the immediate practical thing of avoid this person, right? Because that's clearly a thing that needs to be
like, kind of done.
But really so that I could then sort of like turn the screws and say like, listen, like this is valuable work.
Yeah. Even if you don't think so.
And and I know other people who are claiming that this is their active plan, right? They are actively waiting on publication news so that they can just not for themselves, but to turn the screws on someone else, right?
Yeah, to drop it into
absurd.
Conversation
and that's,
or like that email or
that's
the mixer
so,
and go.
It's so dirty. It is so dirty, and it's only something that harms the self,
oh yeah, absolutely.
Right.
But I think what's interesting is that in a way, kind of academia encourages this kind of behavior. Like I remember in like one of the first years of my PhD, my supervisor sat me down and was like, you know, if I were you, John, I don't know if I would do a PhD. Like, I don't know if I would try and get into this line of work. And, you know, they were actually trying to do me a favor, really. They were trying to kind of honestly
yeah.
tell me the kind of struggle of doing a PhD when the kind of funding is this competitive and when the situation is this tough. But inside,
yeah.
there was inside my head, there was this voice that just went, ah, I'll show you. I'll show you. I'm going to prove you wrong. I'll show you. And I was like, whoa,
yeah.
whoa, that's not a healthy attitude to take.
No,
and
no, because it doesn't affect
no,
them.
No, they will be fine.
Right? That's the major thing, right? right? So like, even if you get bad, even if you're dealing with someone who's like a total bastard, someone who's like really bad and nasty and like a despicable, deplorable human being in terms of like what they do and what they say and things like that, you still end up hurting yourself, right? More than you'll ever hurt them,
oh,
right?
Completely.
You're not going to prove them wrong because you got like one publication or because you got like a job or something like that. It's not something that actually hurts them unless if they're even more petty than you are.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Right? And this is what you said at the beginning, that often kind of this resentment is it's self-inflicted. That other person
not
even be aware of how you feel about it. You know, it's not troubled
them. Usually they're not.
It's not troubled them in the slightest. They have gone about their day unaware that you've been left kind of stewing and turning over and over in your mind all of the details of everything they said or everything they did. And, you're quite right. It's not going to make any difference whatsoever. Because this is the thing that I ended up kind of realizing to like very recently. Because I was approached by a master's student I had taught who wanted to talk about doing a PhD. And I sat him down and I was like, honestly, right now, I the only ethical answer that I could honestly give is that I don't think you should do one. Like, what kind of responsible teacher would I be if I was like, yeah, go for it, it'll be fine, because it may not be, and it's an incredible challenge, but they went, I'll show you, I'm gonna prove you wrong. And I'm like, no,
I'm gonna prove you wrong, John.
I mean, I understand the
what
impulse.
Doesn't kill me makes me stronger, John. I'm gonna destroy you, John. I'm going to destroy you by succeeding.
My success
is a testament to your failure.
Yeah, my success is
right?
your failure.
Which, it's absurd, right? So, like, so I've been someone who's been, you know, dealing a lot with, I've dealt with, like, anxiety and depression issues my entire life, right? For those of you who are new, I don't know. This is me. I used to harbor a lot of resentment for like rejections and things like that. And then I just discovered that like I could just delete those emails. Right?
Just have a filter.
That's what when I get these things where it's like, oh, whatever, I just look for the word unfortunately and then I just delete.
Don't do it to yourself.
Right? Because it's never delete your rejections. Like, that's my major, like, that's my like, ethos when it comes to, like, academia, is apply often, delete your rejections. Right? Because there's no psychological benefit to reading or to even coming across these things again.
It's just another kind of kick.
Like, yeah. And like I'm someone who sort of like I get haunted by things anyway, right? I get haunted by disappointment. So it's best for me, I've found, to just delete everything, right? Whenever it's like really disappointing news, is to just delete the thread, delete whatever, and what so that I can just
I think just I kind of I'm kind of wondering whether there is something kind of specific either about academia or kind of like, you know, the marketized higher education environment that encourages this, or whether it's a kind of wider condition of a particular cultural or political moment. Because you know, it's striking that it's Nietzsche who's the great philosopher of resentment, you know, and it seems to be like sort of the condition of modernity in a way, is this driving subjective resentment of people who probably have no idea how you feel. You know, they are. So I wonder, what do you think about that? Whether you think there's something kind of specifically, or maybe we could talk about both. Whether there is something specific about higher education that drives this emotional affect and the kind of wider political and cultural moment it might tie into.
I mean, we can talk biographically about Nietzsche, at least in the sense that, like, Birth of Tragedy, he sees as being the sort of like career suicide, right? So he probably like he gets a job as a philologist,
At the age of like
and then
23,
starts
right?
talking about like. Yeah. So like he has like a very promising career very early, right? And then it kind of peters out when he writes this kind of like book that nobody really understands. And then he just kind of everyone kind of like distances himself themselves from him. And then he has the health issues. He has like he has he is just severe disability that isn't really like it's not very clear as to what it was, right? Or it wasn't very clear at the time, and things like that. People have conjectured plenty of like post hoc armchair diagnoses or post
Which,
mortems
as
on
we
him,
discussed,
but
you
like
shouldn't
he's
do.
someone which, as we discussed, you shouldn't do. And I think that it's something that he's someone who definitely lived his resentment and things like that. And it was a very academic sort of sense of it because he ended up like out of the academy and things like that. But yeah, I think we're sort of we have this idea of with this sort of competition, with this sort of academic competition and things like that, if you publish a book, you then end up with like feedback on the book, and you end up sort of discussing like people end up hating you for it or like whatever, and like or like you hate like someone who said like something like marginally off from what your work was, right? That sort of I hate citing Woody Allen, but the scene in Annie Hall, you know nothing of my work, right? That
I
sort
know what you mean.
of
All those kind of jokes that we
that
make
sort of
about
thing,
Reviewer
right?
2.
And that's I think that's inherent is this resentment, right? Within like I can't say or I won't say that it's something that necessarily belongs in academia or like whether we can like remove it without removing like or without making a huge change to the way that it's structured at this point I have no idea, but like yeah it's
I
an
think
issue.
one of the things it really
It's a
kind of
huge issue.
brings out is the fragility and contingency of any kind of collegial relationship especially for people at the beginnings of their career,
Yeah.
because it's like you might really like the people that that are in your kind of PhD cohort. You might really get on with them on a personal level, but when it comes to things like chasing grant applications or looking for publication opportunities, we're sort of told that like it's like you know you've got to these are your co these are not your colleagues, these are your competition. You know, this is your competition for the next job,
Yeah.
for the next teaching post, for the next, you know, whatever that's going to give you that kind of reward. So it becomes very easy to see the people around you as a threat, without them doing anything, without them saying anything. They become someone who is a target that you have to either avoid or you have to beat. And I think that is kind of reflective of, I mean, personally, I don't think it should be in academia, you know, but as you say, how do we get rid of that without kind of burning the neoliberal university to the ground and then trying to start again?
And yeah, it's something where like we always try to see this as like what is like how do I vindicate myself or like how do I outdo someone? And like it's dark, right? It's very dark.
Yeah.
And we and so like I think one condition or like just to sort of like transition from resentment to Schadenfreude is that the condition is that we hope for the worst for other people,
Yeah,
right?
frequently.
Frequently, right? We hope like even in the political sphere, we hope that like something really bad is gonna happen, right? To people that we resent, right? There's this sort of there's this thing that I keep seeing, right, amongst liberals is like and I mean like neoliberal, like sort of like not you know not far left, but like well sometimes the far left, but like this sort of sense of like the suffering that's going to happen under Trumpism, right? The suffering that is going to happen with particular groups who voted for Trump, right? Like people, poor people who are now realizing that they're going to lose their health benefits, and things like that. As if it's deserved, right? You
Oh
deserve
yeah, well
this
what did you
because you voted for
expect,
him.
you know?
What? Yeah, I mean the what did you? And I think that there's I think that there's a way to sort of be nuanced, right? There's a way to say like, what did you expect, or like this is what you asked for, without saying also, but this is also what you
Yes.
deserve,
Yeah.
right? And this is a hard line to cross because it's also like I don't want, like I have no sympathy for Trump voters. I really don't, especially like even the ones who are stuck like starting to regret the implications of their vote. I don't have pity or sympathy, but nevertheless, it's not that I think that they should die of lead poisoning in their
Their
water or
inability to
like
afford
of
medication,
like
you know.
yeah, like it's like but there's this resentment and I think passive Schadenfreude in the political sphere or in the political sense of like hot takes, saying that like, well, you voted for this and you deserve all the things
Yeah.
that happened to you because of this
When
vote, right? And I think that that's like I think really maybe this is me, this is the atheist in me speaking or the existentialist atheist in me speaking, but like it has this overwrought sense of what happens is moral,
Yeah.
right? Or like the existential is moral or something like that. Like whatever is and there's like this everything happens for a reason bullshit, right? Which like I resent everyone who says this, right? It's like, oh, No, everything happens because it had like certain determinations or causes or effects and things like that, but it doesn't mean that like there's an overarching moral compass that's like,
Yeah.
hello, this child deserves to
I mean,
die or something
I
like
think
that. Like it's
that's maybe the kind of to look at it from a different perspective. This idea that surely it's possible to critique the choices of Trump voters without wishing them kind of personal moral harm or actual physical harm, because there are going to be, as you say, so many who lose what kind of tenuous access to healthcare they have, who are going to lose the tenuous standards of like environmental safety that they have, and this will be sold to them as the kind of under that ideological banner of this is what it will take to make America great again, and that is going to come along with a huge increase, which we've already started to see, of virulent racism, Islamophobia, xenophobia, because there has to be a scapegoat. There has to be an other.
And it's something where like fascism is very much a sort of like sense of resentment and Schadenfreude, right? Is like we resent these others, right? This is something I just read in the meantime of you having technical difficulties. There's a Sarah Ahmed just put out a blog post about like how maybe we shouldn't be or maybe women shouldn't and people in diverse sort of backgrounds and things like that, they shouldn't be smiling, right? Maybe in part with in hand with the women's strike, right, which is today, and whatever happens out of that. Maybe women shouldn't be just smiling for everything because this sort of expectation of happiness is a bit absurd. And she mentions how fascism is something out of resentment, but she also mentions that like fascism also operates on this sort of sense of love, right? This love of this thing that is seen as fragile, right? This love of the thing that we see as being like there, and we're kind of trying to figure it there's something under threat, right? So we must protect this thing that's under threat. And I think it is this sense that like love and resentment are kind of they're intertwined, right? To a
Yeah,
large
absolutely.
degree.
Jealousy is.
At least the sort of general notions of love that we talk about, they're intertwined and they're just constantly like are sort of social conditions for love or social conditions for like romance and things like that. They're always within this sort of sense of like resentment and jealousy and kind of wishing that someone that things will just happen in a certain like within one's own sort of purview, like the thing that you will get your comeuppance for harming me, even if that harming me is just a slight, right? Or even if it's just something minor, maybe it would be better to do something else, right? Maybe it would be better to just get up and leave. Maybe it would be better to just like do whatever. But like love, marriages, things like that, like they have resentment as well, to a large degree, right? There's the Mountain Goat song, right? No
Oh
Children. I love that song, right? So it's this tongue-in-cheek, like rant against a marriage, right? Or like a bad marriage, right? And it's just, oh, it's so beautiful in just yelling, I hope you die. I hope we both die. Right? That's like the resentment of like a bad marriage or a bad relationship, is this sort of sense of jealousy of like, I hope that this just destroys just both of us. Right?
I think it's hard. It does. I think that does explain really well this the kind of phenomena of Trump, you know, this ability to tap into the kind of love of this mythical prelapsarian America where everything was great, and at the same time the resentment of all of those others who you can you can tap into resentment so powerfully with just kind of a few key ideological buzzwords and dog whistles. You can all you need to say is, you know, I watched 13th earlier like the other week, which is such a brilliant bit of filmmaking.
For those of you who can't see, there's a very large cat that's just
to make an appearance
on top of my chest.
Sorry. So I watched 13th, Ava DuVernay's brilliant documentary, where it kind of tracks how this tapping into resentment has discursively shifted, where you know you don't talk about sort of black criminals anymore. You talk about inner cities and disorder, and you don't talk about thugs. Yeah, you don't talk about you know, you instead of you talk about welfare, and you talk about you know, Medicaid, and you talk about the EBT cards. So you don't talk about the kind of wider issue that you're trying to.
You don't say.
You drive away at this idea that there are people out there who are getting things that you are not, and it's their fault. It's their
you
fault.
You resent people, right? And like you resent people who are poorer than you.
Oh yeah.
Right. And like that's the other thing, is like out of this whole, like this is like the brilliance of white supremacy, right? Or like the is that. It manages to say, like, oh, well, these people have, like, or, like, wow, I just said these people. So African-American populations, people of color, immigrants, et cetera, et cetera. To say that, oh, well, they have special privileges or special, like because we're paying attention to them, that's a special privilege, right? Or, like, because they end up getting government handouts or government benefits, right, for welfare and things like that. Like, oh, well, clearly they're squandering it, or like clearly like they're not spending it in the way that I would spend it, right? And then you have like fucking Chaffetz.
Oh my
saying,
goodness. Talking about
yesterday. Oh well, you know, they would rather like people. Like poor people would rather like buy an iPhone than healthcare or some absurd thing. Like I'm not going to quote
there's
him
such
directly
hatred.
Because,
there's
because
such
it was
kind
absurd.
Of vicious resentment towards people who are poor.
Yeah.
There was this. I saw.
Yeah. And like how, and it's this resentment of like how dare you even exist
in this great capitalist utopia that is America? How dare you be poor? Because you're exposing the lie.
How dare you be poor when I am not poor, right? Which is like there's this resentment that doesn't even happen with like most discussions of resentment discuss of it as being like the underdog, right? Being the underdog, being the person who's downtrodden, being the person who's like destroyed and things like that. But we have these resentments, we have these Schadenfreude understandings of other people, right? Where it's not even a question of looking up or being resentful of the person that is in power to you, but like resentful of the people who need help, right? Or the people who dare ask for help or dare
and like, I definitely
exist.
Think it's because
and it's, remind
they are a visible sign of the catastrophic injustice that the kind of normalized system rests upon. There was this Fox News graphic that I saw floating around where it said at the top in big inverted commas, poor households, and it's like 80% of them own a refrigerator and like 60% have a microwave.
How dare they
have food? And it's
That's been like so. Those are that's relatively old, right? It's this long.
Just the same here in the UK. There have been decades, decades of the most vicious invective towards those who are in some way receiving maybe disability benefit, maybe unemployment benefit. And the kind of right-wing discourse about them is loathsome. Like, the treatment as under the last Conservative government of people with disabilities in the UK is disgusting. You know, and disabled activists have been sort of screaming about this for such a long time that the assessments to and the fit-for-work tests that were brought out were killing people. You know, there were people who were told they had to get a job when they were in no way ready or able to do so, and there have been thousands of cases where people have died because of this, and it is resentment. It is because you know these people who desperately need help expose the lie that is this is a beneficent, well-meaning society where all you need to do is work hard. That's what it is. You know, if you are poor, if you're disabled, if you need the help of the state in some way, it is a personal moral failing. That's the kind of message that has been rammed home for, I mean, since Reagan and Thatcher. If not before.
Yeah.
If not before.
But since before, right? Since always, right? And you know, there's the long-standing sort of like just you know, sneering at someone and saying like get a job when they're homeless, right? As if like that's a thing when you're homeless to be able to do. Oh yeah, I just hadn't considered that, right? And that sort of thing. But then there's also like this sort of hope, right? There's this like passive Schadenfreude hope of like, well, maybe they'll just die. Maybe they'll just disappear. And then I don't necessarily have to think about this anymore. Like if they just weren't here, they didn't exist. Right. And that's the sickness. I keep trying to say sickness, but that's not the right way. That's the problem. Right? That's the problem, is this idea of saying, like, well, really,
There's something that kind of reminds me of, there was this, Manchester at the moment has had a huge kind of explosion in its homeless population. The last parliament has seen kind of the council's social care budget slashed to the bone, they have no money, and so if you walk through Manchester city centre, there are You'll pass in a 10-minute walk. You'll pass dozens of people who are sleeping rough. And a while ago, they kind of organized protests in very visible parts of the city, where they would just bring their tents and they would camp there, and just be seen by people. And at every point, Manchester Council saw like police injunctions, legal injunctions to force them to move. And I was like, well, where are they going to go? You know, their demand was housing. They need a place to live. And the council was like, no, we just want them to be invisible. Yeah. We want them to be gone. We want them to be moved somewhere that no one can see them. And it's like, well, that hasn't solved the problem.
Yeah.
You know, it's just made you feel better.
Yeah.
About what's happened.
Yeah.
The fact,
yeah.
You know, they...
Yeah. And maybe...
As you say, they just want them to be invisible.
Yeah, it's just this... Yeah, it would be better, it would just be better if, like, within this sort of resentful way of seeing things, within this sort of resentful way of discussing, like, the poor and the impoverished and the homeless and the
yeah.
mentally ill as well, right? Because that, and the disabled and so on and so forth. It would be better if they
yeah.
just disappeared. Is the mentality, and that's the mentality that always substantiates
yeah.
fascism, right? Or like sort of like this sort of sense of Schadenfreude, this sense of resentment, this sense of sort of like this liberal, even this liberal understanding of it is like, well, maybe if they weren't there. Or, like, maybe if we just gave them, like, a certain amount of
yeah.
tokenism or something like that, then
yeah.
maybe things would be better.
You know...
Right. And it's...
I think that's
obscene.
The right word.
It's
is
a very
obscene.
Vulgar...
It exposes
yeah.
the kind
yeah.
of cruelty, the logic of cruelty that this kind of runs on.
Yeah.
This notion that... I genuinely do think that's why there is such kind of resentment, because just by existing, just by being in the world, there is the kind of lie that we have been told over and over again, the ideological position that, you know, America is the land where anyone can make it. Who was it? It was either Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio who gave a speech where he said that America is not a nation of haves and have-nots. It's a nation of haves and soon-to-haves. I was like, that is a lie. That is a horrible, pernicious, obscene lie.
Yeah. Unless if you think that the haves are like the soon-to-haves, like... Yeah, maybe also they'll just disappear or something like that, right? And it's this sickening, like, it's the Protestant work ethic. It's the sort of like capitalist understanding of like, well,
yeah.
you're just not trying hard enough, right? So if you're not trying hard enough, you're just gonna fail, and then like your failure is going
yeah.
to be a motivating story
yeah.
for someone else, right? Because that's the second, that's the like really like nauseating thing out of this, right? Is that we then take all of these stories of like people who suffer and people who fail, people who try and fail, people who fail because they can't try, and things like that. We see this as like, well,
yeah,
you know, this is the cautionary tale, right? You're supposed to try, and if you don't try, or if you don't
yeah.
succeed, you haven't
yeah.
tried hard enough, right? And it's that bullshit that comes out of The Secret. It's this bullshit that comes out of most, like, a lot of cultisms, right? Like, Scientology and things like that. Like, it's that you're not, it's that
oh,
you
it,
don't
it comes
have
out in academia
willpower,
as well.
Right?
Especially around employment.
Yeah. Oh, it's everywhere. It's this sort of like unspoken ideology that nobody really like. That a lot of people just don't necessarily realize is the sense that like, well, I have feelings about how like things are okay. I want to say that things are okay. Things will remain okay. For those who it's not okay, like,
yeah,
it's on you. It's not, that's not my problem, right? And like, I think at the very least, right? And this is a paper that I want to put together at some point, is that at the very least, the substantiation of the status quo, or like the sense in which we say like, okay, things are okay. Right? Or like, I want normalcy or something like that. or I want to remain normal or something like that, is a, at the outset, like this ideological passive Schadenfreude, right? Right. It's inherent within our society that we have Schadenfreude. We have this sense of saying, like, well,
in some
it's
way,
deserved, right? In some way, like, everything happens for a reason. Your suffering happens for a reason. The reason must be that you deserve it. And it's sickening, right? It's this disgusting way of viewing the world. But it's the way that most people operate, I think. Right? And that's the worst part, is, like, we just sort of, like, it's this sort of self-totalizing thing, right? It's just like the sense of, or like, it's hand in hand with capitalism, so of course. But you also see it, like, amongst others, like, like, even people on the left who say that they're anti-capitalist, they turn and say, like, well, you deserve this because you voted for Trump, right? You deserve this awfulness because of this. And, like, you know, I don't think that, I think we should blame Trump supporters outright, right? But not for the sense that they are, that they willed their own destruction. Like, that's not, I don't know. But also, it's not something that can be pitied. Yeah. So it's this very weird, like, I'm trying to, like, there's this very weird line in terms of emotionality towards awful people that I'm trying to figure out, right? Because I don't want to pity them. I don't, but I also don't want to.
I think that
kind of
brings us on to a good point to try and conclude things on, which is the notion of, with this is the kind of integral to the operation of late capitalism. The problem that I think we've been kind of dancing around in various ways is the problem of solidarity and class consciousness. I mean, I think that's the thing that the Schadenfreude and resentment on a kind of political, cultural level destroys and poisons class solidarity. And it's...
Yeah, yeah. Or just, like, even if we want to just say solidarity at large, right? Or something like that. Because it's not all class struggles, but it's... Resentment and Schadenfreude, it divides all of the lines. It divides gender lines. It divides sexual preference lines. It divides economic lines. It divides like health lines, disability lines, all of these things, right? Race, everything is just tied up in this resentment. And Schadenfreude, I wish you the worst. I hope you die. I hope we both die, right? That sort of mentality is just, it's there.
So I think the reason that we have to kind of acknowledge it, the reason that we kind of have to work against it, is precisely because, you know, if there is a sort of oppositional political movement to be built, it has to be built across all of those lines that resentment and Schadenfreude would seek to divide.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not, and, like, also it's not something where we can erase those differences, right? We shouldn't erase these differences or things like that. But the amount of antagonism that happens along different lines, different identities, different like experiences and things like that, that's the problem. And that's the problem within resentment.
Because solidarity, I suppose, is not built in spite of differences. It needs to be built, like, because of them. You know, there has to be... There was a really good piece I read about the Women's March... in Washington, by Sam Chris, talking about all of the signs that people had, and just how incredibly diverse they were, Insisting on LGBT rights and healthcare and racial justice and the fact that refugees are welcome, and it's like it. We have to insist upon that kind of and. We have to insist upon yes, this and this and this and this, because everybody needs the kind of liberation that Schadenfreude and resentment would seek to kind of wedge apart and fracture, and
enable.
So we have to insist upon and
yeah, it has to be. No,
it isn't just one; it is every struggle.
Because there are too many movements where, or there are too many movements that are sort of limited by this sort of attitude.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of, fuck you, I got mine, and that's it's absurd, right? And that fuck you, I've got mine usually is operated by the sense that like someone like has relative success under capitalist conditions, right? Right. So like, someone's a diversity hire, so like they don't necessarily worry about other things, or like they're in the door, they don't want to make any moves, right? Or something like that for anyone else, right? It's why, like, you can see things where, like, the glass ceiling or, like, the racial divide, or, like, if you look at, like, the first African-American person to do X, and then you look at the disparity or, like, the length of time between them and the second, right, of that, right? Because they say, like, oh, well, we already have one, right? Or something like that.
But I think there has to be the insistence
absurd,
that,
right?
You know, whatever struggle is happening over there does not invalidate the struggle that is going on here, because those are intricately bound up with one another, and they need to be if there is to be any kind of lasting success. You know, there are enough issues that we all need to be involved in. You know, it's not like, oh well, if we talk about this, then we can't talk about this. You know, we have to be able to talk about it all, and that takes work, and it takes dialogue, which, again, is something that, as we said right at the beginning, resentment breaks down. You can't talk to somebody if you have that feeling within you. You know, that's a kind of self-poisoning feeling.
Yeah.
You can't, there is no dialogue possible there until it's kind of admitted, and it can be moved past. You know, you don't see your friend in the same way until you go, remember that conversation we had? This has felt really weird for me. Can we talk about it? And that's how you repair it. That's how you get past the resentment.
Yeah. Yeah, and I, you know, that's a good place to stop, I think.
I think so.
So thanks.
Yeah, thank you so
thanks
much.
Thanks all for listening. Again, we are Jake at Cranky Ethicist on
John,
Twitter,
the Lit Crit guy. You can, of course, email us at litcrank@gmail.com.
But any questions, gripes, complaints? Actually,
I was gonna. Can we replace that with suggestions? Suggestions, maybe.
But suggestions for future talks, things like that. We don't want to dedicate anything directly political. Things like that.
Yes.
At some point, we're going to do a film.
I think maybe we might do that for like episode 5. That might be quite kind of fun. 5 feels like a bit of a landmark number. So if there are suggestions of films you would like to see us kind of tackle, please do let us know. Because
either relatively recent films or not. I don't know. I'd love to talk about Logan. Or something like that. Yeah. Or I'm not sure whether I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, that was Scout just making an appearance.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for all of the encouragement that we've had on Twitter.
Yeah.
I hope there is some value in these conversations, and I'm so excited that we get to keep doing them. We will do this again in another 2 weeks time. Okay, so until next time, goodbye.